Off of a struggling artist. It's Martin Galvin. Carja, there's an influential New York radio program, Radio Free Aaron, which begins each week with a theme song that shouts the words, unrepentant Fenian bastard, unrepentant Fenian bastard. And when I, many years ago, first came across those words, they puzzled me. Repentance means somebody did something wrong that they're sorry for, that they're contrite about, that they want forgiveness for. Ruffinian, to me, that word meant something very different. We, today, mark as our national day to remember Ireland's Patriot Dead, Easter, because of the relationship and the bond to the men and women of 1916. And no ceremony to mark them and honor them would be complete without a reading of the proclamation. And they, that generation of Irish volunteers, they looked to the Fenians, whose very graves, they said, guaranteed that Ireland unfree shall never be at peace. And of course, there's another version or usage of the word Fenian, where anybody, any Republican, any Irish man or woman who has not sufficiently bent the knee to the British Crown and to the beneficiaries of the sectarian privilege of the state are regarded as Fenians and called it as a term of abuse. Either way, to me, I thought that that word was a compliment. High praise, another way of saying that someone was an Irish patriot, another way of saying that someone was an Irish Republican. Why should someone be called that, a Fenian, ever be repentant? And why would it be so significant and noteworthy that you'd point out when somebody was a Fenian and was unrepentant? Well, those words, of course, are easier to see the meaning of the phrase today. But Brendan Hughes surely lived his life and died as an unrepentant Irish Fenian. He would have never repented or denied or disavowed his part in the IRA struggle against British rule. Then he could have denied he was from Belfast, or repented that he was an Irishman, or disavowed the legitimacy of the struggle that he was a part of by putting on a criminal uniform in the H blocks of Lancash. The very idea, if somebody had suggested to him that you repent or disavow or deny your part in the IRA struggle in order to make yourself more acceptable to a British administration, in order to be more acceptable to a Paisley or Robinson Red Stormont, would have been answered by him with a sly grin, being told to cuff yourself on, and maybe a few other words that I won't repeat as part of the instruction to do it. Last week, or a little over a week ago, David Cameron took time out from his busy schedule with more important matters and visited Stormont. Part of what he deems and deliberately, repeatedly calls this part of the United Kingdom. And he patted himself on the back. He congratulated himself for that hard-won apology that the Bloody Sunday families fought for decades to get. And then he said he did it to close the chapter. And then he said he did it to differentiate the Bloody Sunday unjustifiable acts from the honorable service of so many who have been in the name of British rule and law. Well, Brendan Hughes, first of all, there doesn't seem to be much repentance in his words, the words of Dave and Cameron, does there? It doesn't seem much repentance for the Ballymurphy massacre, or for torture, or for internment, or shoot to kill, or their part in collusion murders, or for forcing the hunger strike deaths in the H blocks of Lancash, or for any of the many other unjustifiable acts which the British use, selected, chose as tactics to maintain their rule in Ireland. But Brendan Hughes was different. He would have counted himself proud to be one of those who fought against these unjustifiable and unjustified acts which the British used to remain in Ireland, and fought against the very idea that the right of Irish people, all Irish people, to national freedom ends a few miles from here at the border, somewhere here, between here and where Jim McAllister lives. It's hardly necessary for me, in the presence of his family, in the presence of so many people who fought alongside Brendan, fought alongside him, were with him in the streets of Belfast, or were with him in the H-blocks of Lancash. But I just want to measure a bit or talk a bit about his service, if only because there are some who believe that as part of a new political dispensation, you try and dispense with the reputation and the deeds and the exploits of those who do not blindly fall behind the current narrative. Brendan Hughes, I knew him as so many did. Before I ever met him, I knew of him. He was somebody that volunteers in Belfast talked about the same way that some volunteers in Tyrone would talk about a Jim Lynagh or a Pete Ryan or others would talk about Francis Hughes. And of course, there are others in other parts of the country. IRA volunteers, men and women, whose courage was such that they seemed to spill over and inspire everybody who fought with them, who made it seem as if all of the advantages which the British had in terms of weapons, in terms of surveillance, in terms of intelligence, all of that could be neutralized and overcome simply because people like Brendan Hughes were there out on the mission fighting with them and giving those people around him the confidence to believe and achieve that they would indeed succeed and overcome. Brendan was somebody who joined the IRA at the very beginning, came out on the streets of Belfast, rose through the ranks, went to jail, saw a relative, Charlie Hughes, killed, was undeterred by anything. Went to jail, came out again and again, rejoined the fight, rose through the ranks, became a commander, became a leader, led, was a strategist, went to jail again. And then when he escaped, it's characteristic of him that when he escaped, he didn't do it to get to the South. He didn't do it to get to rest. He didn't do it just to get away from the pressure of going to jail. He did it with the idea to get back as quickly as he could, back to Belfast and back into the thick of the fight, where he'd risk going to prison again. When he went to prison again, and then when he was put into the H-box of Lancash, it fell to him to be a leader in the fight against criminalization. He had the unenviable, the impossible task of trying to look around to inspire those, the 300 Spartans, as Richard O'Rod described them, inspiring those men to fight against criminalization that was trying to be enforced upon them in a daily basis of brutality, to stand up to it and at the same time counsel them to be patient, counsel them to wait, counsel them not to escalate the protest too quickly in order to give the Republican movement on the outside, in order to give the H-block Armagh committees an opportunity to build a national and international campaign behind them that could beat Thatcher and criminalization. We know what happened. Initiative after initiative was tried and failed. A final initiative by Cardinal O'Fee was just rebuffed by Thatcher, who was intent on breaking the struggle by breaking the prisoners. And how a hunger strike was forced upon Brendan and the other men in the H-blocks of Lancash. And how Brendan chose to lead that hunger strike. How after that he sustained it for 53 days, it fell to him at a time when Sean McKenna lay near death, at a time when there was a promise that there would be a real solution, real concession, something to end it without costing his life. It fell to Brendan under the pressure of 53 days of hunger strike himself and having undergone years of brutality and protest to call a halt to that hunger strike and give the British a chance. And we know how they reacted. Thatcher saw it not as an opportunity to do justice or resolve the issue for on a humanitarian basis. She saw it as an opportunity to win, to break the prisoners. She forced the hunger strike to begin. She forced the deaths that were to occur. She is ultimately, the British are ultimately responsible for the 10 hunger strike deaths of those grave Irish patriots. After his release, Brendan came to the United States, which was where I first got to know him very well. He was there on a mission that he didn't particularly relish. He was raising money for the Irish Republican movement. And he would say, any monies I raise are not going to go to people like Martin Galvin and Irish Northern Aid. They're not going to go for the families of political prisoners. They're certainly not going to go back to any political cause or Sinn Féin or anything like that. I am collecting money for the Irish Republican Army to try and drive the British out of Ireland. And he was so successful, so strong, so effective, so patient as he listened to people who were contributing, listened to their suggestions, some of them silly, listened to them with the idea of just going back and talking about it afterwards, that he more than doubled the goal which he was given when he was sent out there. And in fact, we say afterwards, years afterwards, in retrospect, that he was too successful. When he came back to Ireland, he was assigned to the security department, where he could be checked by one of Britain's top agents, Freddie Scapatici. And after he left America, who was sent out to take his place but another of Britain's top agents, Dennis Donaldson, to try and knock down everything that Brendan had built up. We know what happened with Brendan, how he continued on, how he came to leave the Republican movement, and how at some point, well, for that, I just want to say I came and visit him when he came back to Ireland. And we used to laugh about it. At that time, for a number of years, the British would talk about how there was no struggle because of anything wrong with British rule. There's no struggle because the Irish people wanted freedom. There's a struggle because of these godfathers who are making money off what's going on, and they're getting rich off the struggle, and they're keeping it going for that reason. And I'd visit Brendan. I'd see the circumstances under which he lived. Here was somebody with so much ability. Here is somebody who had given countless hours, undergone countless suffering, who had done so much, who could have gone into any field and made a wealthy success of himself, who never took anything, never took money, never asked for money, never was rewarded or enriched in any way because of his part in the struggle and made a joke of every propaganda lie the British put out about it. And then came a point, and I think, I would imagine, that this is the hardest thing, emotionally certainly, that Brendan ever had to go through. The point when he came to disagree with the direction that the movement he had given so much for was traveling. When he began to fear and question, are we going to get a united Ireland in this fashion? Or if we accept British rule, if we accept places that are British Stormont administration, are those places going to boomerang against us? Are it going to be turned by the British into something where they simply put a Republican face or faces in the front of British rule and behind that exercise British rule in British interests as they've always done, make the cause of the United Ireland weaker than ever? He raised those questions, and instead of getting answers, he got abuse, he got censorship, he got people who were friends shunning him. And I think that that might have been part of the hardest part of Brendan, to have to go through that, to be met in that way, to get no answers from the struggle, from the leadership that he was so close to, but to get ostracism, to get objections of that type. His arguments were seldom mentioned, seldom defeated on the merits. I don't think they could have been. But instead, people said that it was the burden of long cash. It was the burden of illness. It was the burden of everything that he had been through. And the worst of all the things, the slanders that were totally untrue, would have been that he was raising questions. He was objecting, not because he legitimately felt that the movement that he had given so much to, his loyalty to that struggle demanded that he ask those questions and try and see that that movement would be on the right track. People said it was because of personal animosity, personal grievances. Here is a leadership of which he was intimately involved, which he was close friends, which he had gone to jail with, fought with, been close friends with many of the top leaders. For him to have to hear that it was personal, not something that he would do as a matter of the greatest principle, must have hurt him very deeply. But he continued on again because of his loyalty to the struggle, because of his loyalty to those who were in prison, because of his loyalty to all of the sacrifices that were made. He became a rallying point Others who would have been afraid to stand up alone would stand up because they were with him. Others who came under pressure and who also were slandered and there was an attempt to ostracize them, he would stand with and help them to stand strong. He would put forward those arguments, put forward, stand with others. And again, this is an ostracism that was so strong that some people, we had one IRA volunteer, Whitey Bradley, commit suicide simply because of writing a book and the pressures that he was put under. Brendan became a rallying point. Brendan stood with those who were under pressure. Brendan ensured that the debate was going to continue. He stood by that throughout his life. He stood by that even if in his death, the voices from the grave spoke up, not again for any benefit or personal thing, but because his loyalty to the movement, he wanted to see it go right and get back on the path to a united Ireland even after he was gone. That's why he spoke the voices of the grave. That's why he stood with anyone who would engage in a debate. Today, it comes back to the questions that he asked. Are we on the road to a united Ireland? Has joining a British administration, taking up seats at Stormont, taking up places on constabulary boards, is that bringing us closer to a united Ireland? Are we now working with the DUP on more DUP members and voters? Are they now going to vote for a united Ireland, see their interests lie there, and overcome the unionist veto that's been conceded as part of the Stormont deal? Or are the questions which Brendan raised still valid? Are we actually in the midst of a British trap? Are we in a situation where the British are trying to draw us into that storm and configuration of British rule? Point to the fact that there are Republicans there. You see how great our rule is in Ireland. Even we've given places to some who are our biggest enemies. Use them to go ahead and maintain and perpetuate that British rule. When you recruit and ask people to take up places in a constabulary, to take up places in a British civil service, is that going to help us change people's minds and say we should be voting for a united Ireland? Or are people who get jobs, are people who take up positions, are people who take ministries, are some of them going to start to say, you know, British rule isn't so bad for me? Well, there was a headline in the Irish news yesterday that seemed to suggest that that's part of what is happening, as the number of nationalists who want a united Ireland, according to the Irish news headline, goes down. Let's look at what is happening and to do it in the terms that Brendan would have asked us to do. At what is closest to his heart, the issue of Republican prisoners. Look at what is now happening in McGabbery. 30 years ago, Republicans were in the midst of a hunger strike. It was a hunger strike which was the end result of years of what I call naked brutality inflicted on prisoners who were naked except for a blanket, inflicted on them as they were taken out of their cells to go to the bathroom, inflicted on them during mirror searches, inflicted on them during strip searches, inflicted upon them as they were moved from wing to wing or cell to cell. And today in McGabbery, we see Republican political prisoners, again, victims of naked brutality, beaten as they are leaving the prison, beaten as they go to court, beaten as they are strip searched. When the hunger strike, the movement towards the hunger strike was going on, when the H Block Armagh Committee was trying to build support, many of the people who joined that committee, Cardinal O'Keefe first and foremost, did not do so on the basis that they thought, if we support the hunger, if we support the H Block Armagh prisoners, we're endorsing their actions, we're endorsing the war. They did it because they said, these are Republican prisoners who can be supported on a humanitarian basis. They did it because they said that these were men and women who were jailed by special laws, who were taken before special non-jury diplock courts, who would never have seen the inside of a prison except for British rule and the political nature of the conflict in their country. Why cannot Sinn Féin support the McGabbery political prisoners on that same basis today? Why do we see David Ford, a handpicked, compromised nominee that had to be approved by Sinn Féin. Not only the one responsible for this brutality, responsible for breaking the agreement of August 12th, but getting on television and saying no concessions, no, 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 in an almost Thatcher-like way, and members of Sinn Féin who helped to appoint him doing nothing to stop him and gaining justice for Republican political prisoners at the Gabbard. Are the ministries which they've taken up, are the power which they have in Stormont, are the places on constabulary boards, are the appointment of David Ford, is that showing us that we are getting closer to a united Ireland, that we're changing things for the better, or does that show us that things are now getting worse because that strategy is headed in a wrong direction? Just want to mention two prisoners, although I don't want to in any way lessen the plight of anybody else or undermine anybody else or say anybody else is in the same position or entitled to our support. One is Marion Price. Marion Price is in jail, not because of anything she did or attended at an Easter commemoration in Derry. She got bail on that charge. She is in jail on license because of something she did in the 70s for the Irish Republican Army, an attack in England. One of the people who has one of the highest positions in Stormont, who has one of the highest positions on a constabulary board, Jerry Kelly, was with her on that same operation. Why is she allowed to remain in prison? Why is there no way in which that license or revocation of her license is challenged? Is she going to be the first of many for whom a license is used as a license to intern by revocation by the British? And is this the first action where we say it's soon going to be outlawed to attend an Easter commemoration in the six counties and simply speak up and defend the words of the leaders of 1916? Second prisoner I want to mention is Jerry McGill. Jerry is somebody who is in jail right now, was jailed in February of 2011, because in 1981, shortly before the death of Joe McDonald, in the middle of the hunger strike, he was accused of being involved in an Irish Republican Army gun battle with a member of the Ulster Defense Regiment, in which both Jerry and that member of the Ulster Defense Regiment were wounded. Why was that charge trotted up after so many years? And we all know it's because he ran for office as an independent Republican, critical of any endorsement of the Royal Ulster Constabulary, a rebranded Royal Ulster Constabulary, now called the PSNI. Why is it he's in jail? And so many, the troops from Bloody Sunday, those who have undergone shoot to kill, those who tortured, those who committed perjury. How many members of the British Crown Forces have been given an unstated selective amnesty by the Crown? Well, Jerry McGill is a Republican, goes to jail. Why is there no silence or power or influence to get him out of that prison by those to whom he was loyal in 1981 at the time that he engaged in that attack? Again, are we moving towards a united Ireland, or does this show us we're moving away from it? Lastly, David Cameron, again, as I said, was in Stormont a little over a week ago. His words clearly show how he feels. He thinks it's all done and dusted. He said the constitutional issue is settled. He talked about any possibility of getting a nationalist majority in the north, in the six counties, as slightly worse than the odds you would have for paying lotto tonight. He thinks it's finished because he thinks that by the Stormont agreement, by that deal, they have drawn Sinn Féin, they've drawn republicanism into a trap where the goal of the United Ireland is locked away just as tightly as Brendan Hughes and the 300 Spartans used to be locked away by the British in the H-box of Ancash. Well, Thatcher thought the same thing about Brendan Hughes and the others. She thought they were beaten. She thought they were dealt with. She thought it was all over many times. And she was wrong. She was wrong because Brendan Hughes and the other blanket men, because those who supported them, had the determination, had the courage to keep on, no matter what the British could throw against them, and continue the fight and break Thatcher and show the world that Republican prisoners were not criminals and beat her. Can we do the same now? One of the things that was crucial, and I attended some of the H Block Armagh committee meetings, the differences between some of the groups, between some of the personalities in that room were unbelievable. But those groups, those individuals came together to wield and forge a mighty force in support of those prisoners. They did it because they were inspired by Brendan and the H Block prisoners. They did it because they saw how important and crucial it was. They did it because they put aside anything that would keep them from working for a victory for the blanket men and ultimately for the hunger strike. Question I'll leave you with. At the spot where the ashes of this unrepentant Feeney and Brendan Hughes are scattered, can we not do the same? Can we overcome whatever differences we might have? Can we say that the issue of prisoners in McGabbery, the whole issue of the United Ireland that the British think now is done and dusted and dealt with, that that's got to be overcome? That we have to do something to reclaim republicanism, to bring it back from the Stormont trap that the British have set for us, to put it back on the road to a united Ireland, the Ireland that Brendan Hughes and so many unrepentant Fenians fought for, struggled for, and gave so much of their lives for. Can we not do that, ladies and gentlemen?